What might we see in the future of biological engineering? Now, that may seem a little off-brand for this show, but stick around and we'll talk about it. Welcome to the Grand Hill Chronicles podcast. My name is Don Bishop, and I write as T.S. Pedramon. Now, today I bring you an interview. This is our third interview with Noah Healy, and we dive into kind of the blurring the lines between science fiction and reality as we see technology marching forward. And I think it gives some pretty good world-building fodder for people who write science fiction and even fantasy as well. It just kind of explores possibilities that may exist, no matter how you may approach them being accomplished in your fiction, whether it's by some magical spell or through science and engineering. Next week, I can't believe I'm having to correct myself on this point, but the original recording that I made for the introduction, I said next week we're going to hear from one author, and we're actually hearing from another one. I shuffled around the weeks that I'm publishing episodes, so next week we will be hearing from Robert Jacob, who writes nonfiction about pirates. I had a terribly interesting conversation with him, and I think you'll enjoy that interview next Thursday. Now, this is somebody that I met in my real life before trying to venture as an author. We actually met professionally 12 years ago, but I'll let that come out next week. Enjoy the show. Today, before we go any further, I want to kind of give a couple of announcements. So I don't currently have any signing events on the books in the near future, because I've been really busy. I haven't scheduled them, and I am in the thick of getting my old house ready to put on the market for sale. And so, like, after recording this, I'm going to run back over there and put some shoe mold around the kitchen and, move furniture out of there and get it ready for putting on the market. But for now, I do want to let you know that I have jumped on a couple of promotions. So if you have been holding off and want to try my book, I'll tell you two secrets. My book will be is featured in some promotions. I paid to get the word out, through these channels, through written word media. But in order to playwright for the promotion, I am offering a lower price for the ebook. That's how it works. So that will run on June 18th and 19th. There are a couple of different promos that I'm being pushed out through. And during that time, my ebook will be priced at 99 cents. And in order to make sure that it is there and ready, I'm going to go into Amazon and set that up again before I go over to my old house after I finish recording this. So by the time you hear this, it might already be priced at 99 cents, not just on Amazon, but everywhere. But wait, maybe you don't have the 99 cents. Then I will tell you another secret. On June 23rd, there will be a large Stuff Your Kindle Fantasy Edition event, and this is just organized among authors. And so on June 23rd, there's going to be a lot of titles in the fantasy realm, fantasy genre, that will be for free, and I'm participating in that. I am not in Kindle Unlimited. My ebook is available wide. So Amazon will not let me price my book for free. but I can price it for free everywhere else. And that will be the case on June 23rd. But I'll tell you, the secret goes a little deeper. There is a, in order to be part of this promotion, and it's not through Amazon, it's not through Written Word Media, it's just a group of authors. And so I'll provide a link in the show notes where you can go and see all the titles that are being offered. And so you can go and download those for free on June 23rd. But since I can't price my book for free on Amazon, I provided a download page via BookFunnel. And that page is actually live right now. So I will include that in the show notes. So if you want to buy for 99 cents and support me a little bit, that's nice. I thank you. I will appreciate it. I don't know exactly when that price will be effective, because when you change the regular price, because again, I'm wide and Amazon won't let me schedule a promotion. That means if I want to make sure that it is priced at 99 cents on the 18th, I'm going to go in there, I'll 5 days early. And so tomorrow, when you hear this on June 13th, I'm looking at the clock on my computer. I'm recording this intro on the 12th. So tomorrow, by the time you hear this, it'll probably be 99 cents everywhere, just to make sure that it is there next week. You know, when I don't want people clicking on the promotion and then finding my book still at $7.99. It's regular full price. So if you want to do that, great. You know, and in order to price it at 99 cents, I have to choose a lower royalty share. So if you want to help me out, don't buy it on Amazon. Go anywhere else. Go to grindhill.media, because that's mine. And I pay some fees for hosting, and I pay some fees for processing, transaction payments. I really worded that awkwardly. But and then after that, I pay sales tax. But apart from that, I get to keep all of it. So if you want to help, if you really want to help out, go and buy it from grindhill.media. But that will be 99 cents. I can guarantee it, because I control it. Anyway, so I was saying, on Amazon, I can't schedule promotion. I can go in and change the regular price, but it still has to go through their approval. And it'll probably just take 15 minutes. But just in case it takes like 3 days, I'm going to go in there today and change the regular price until after that promotion has concluded. And I don't remember exactly when. I don't remember exactly the names of the promotions I signed up for, because you get it like a month in advance. And I don't remember exactly when they end. So it might be June. I'll leave it 99 cents through the Stuff Your Kindle Day event on June 23rd. And so let's call it June 25th or 26th. My price will go back up to the regular price of $7.99 for the ebook. So Stuff Your Kindle on June 23rd. If you want my book for free, ándale pues, as they say. You can check the link in the show notes, and it's live now, and I'll give you that link so listeners to the podcast can download the ebook for free right now. And other than that, let's get into the interview. And I'm not going to record an outro, so once the interview's over, then we'll see you next week, and enjoy the book. Welcome to the Grindhill Chronicles podcast. This podcast is brought to you by my book, Nightshade Unicorn Forerunner. Forerunner is the first book. The series is Nightshade Unicorn. You can get it on Amazon. You can buy it directly from me at grindhill.media. Now, today I have again on the pod with me Noah Healy, who has been on a couple of times before. Now, Noah, for those who may have not heard our previous two episodes, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Well, my name is Noah Healy. I am a recreational mathematician, and my interest is computational mathematics. I also had training in nuclear engineering. I'm widely read in science fiction. I have my own podcast with the former CTO of Reddit, The Fourth Age, and I'm fighting with the patent office about a new marketplace system that I developed that potentially would double human wealth if it went into general circulation, and they're objecting to that on that grounds, in fact, right now. So anyhow, that's who I am.
Thank you. So today we were going to talk about biology, but before we jump into that, I'm starting to think maybe we should have another episode and talk about your ideas for marketplace, which I have not read or listened to what those ideas are, but I think we could have an episode and we could talk about those particulars, but just an episode about different economic systems in general, because for somebody who writes fiction like me, or for somebody who consumes fiction like me, or anybody else who reads or watches movies, there are different societies. Different societies have different economic systems.
Absolutely. Well, I'm certainly open to that. So, I have been sort of peppering in economic consequences. So in the first episode, we talked about, blockchain, Bitcoin, and I mentioned YAP. The previous episode, we were talking about 3D printing. And I was talking about, you know, changes that could alter how retail, wholesale, and so on involve. And so that's one of the things. It's very sort of easy to write science fiction in a superficial fashion where you're like, you know, what if people could fly? And then you've got these flying characters and then that's it. And everybody acts the way people act and, you know, history doesn't change or anything. And of course, you know, lots and lots of changes would happen all over the place if there was a different set of constraints that were being placed on people. And so that's the really big deal with computers. We have this entirely new kind of system for thinking about, even thinking about things, and we still have the same kinds of universities, the same kinds of governments, the same kinds of religions, in many cases, the same kinds of medicine and accounting and engineering that we had 50, 60 years ago before computers had really gone into any kind of general use. And we should probably expect that we're going to need new versions of most of those things. And so when you're writing a sci-fi story, that's something that's worth considering is when you're building the world, how does it all kind of keep flowing around?
Yeah. Now, before we really jump into this theme with biology, I want to give it context. So for somebody like me, and I want our listeners to really kind of dream and imagine as we, because we're kind of doing this series, right? Like the blurring line between science fiction and reality. But I'm going to jump full into science fiction or fantasy for a moment and say, like, we have The Dragon Riders of Pern is, by Anne McCaffrey. And I have her son's book here. It's written in that universe, in that world. This one's called Dragon's Kin. I still have to read it. I haven't read it yet. But in that world, it's a fantasy series with a sci-fi origin. The sci-fi origin is Dragon's Dawn. I bought that book when I was 12 years old, and it fascinated me. So we have these fire-breathing lizards. There's a little bit of an explanation about, like, they chew a rock and they can spit fire. And now humans arrive on this planet, and there's this dangerous substance that falls from the sky that just devours any organic material. But the little dragon lizards burn it up. And so the humans are like, well, we need to protect these sheep that we brought, these crops that we're growing, and these dragon lizards are helpful. So they do genetic engineering and make them really big. Now they're dragons. So that's one thing that dreaming with sci-fi, right? Another thing is, I hesitate because this isn't really biology, but it interfaces with biology. Nanites. I think we touched on that a little bit last time. So nanites, and I have pictured in the Grand Hill Chronicles, which is not complete, is not published, one day will be. I imagine that as a fantasy series with a sci-fi backstory, ancient history backstory, where the magic that you see executed is done in the background, perhaps by nanites or some other biological interface thing. And then there was one other thing I wanted to, maybe not one other. Oh yeah, there was another thing I was thinking of, but in Red Rising, which is a fascinating book with sequels series, it's science fiction placed at least 700 years in the future. I think it's placed probably more 1,000 or more years in the, or more years in the future. And there are the classism in that series is done by eye color. And it ranges from gold to purple to red to black to white to silver. And typically eye color is accompanied by hair color, but it's not always. But eye color is their basis for class. But the golds are in control. They're the ruling class. And the main character, it's called Red Rising. So in their social stratification, reds are at the bottom. And the main character is a very clever and quick red who is hanged. And then this is early in the book, so it's not much of a spoiler, but okay, spoiler alert. He's rescued from hanging secretly, pulled down before he's dead and buried as if he is dead. But he's rescued and in a secret laboratory or clinic, whatever, he gets doctored. They doctor him up. They do gene splicing and surgeries and whatnot to make him turn him into a gold, which it adds to his stature like a foot and a half, I think, but makes him big, imposing. And also in this world, there are monstrosities that are created by their they call them carvers, I guess veterinarians. So these monsters that are made of animals grafted together or just genetically engineered. So somebody living on one of the moons of Saturn has a griffin, which is pretty cool. But anyway, so these things from the nanites to the dragons to the monstrosities are things that one might dream or daydream about coming from biology. And I'm sorry for such a long introduction. Now we're going to bring it back home into reality and take these first steps. So I'll hand it over to you, Noah, and let you go from here. Cause you had mentioned Google's gene splicing, but you don't have to start
right.
there.
Yeah. Yeah. There's sort of two very interesting things where our current technology is intersecting with our present knowledge, and then there's some other stuff where there's very big changes that we obviously have to make but don't understand how to do and aren't currently doing. So the two sort of big things that are happening very, very in the background right now is that a couple of years ago now, Google's DeepMind team, which is the most successful stable superintelligence producing team on Earth, solved a protein folding competition. So just quick intro. Life is actuated chemically, and in order to get those chemical reactions to happen, enzymes are necessary to adjust the energy levels. So your body, my body, we operate by burning hydrogen and turning it into water. And that reaction occurs at roughly the temperature that wood burns, because that's what that reaction is. And so our bodies, if we didn't metabolize that process efficiently, would operate at roughly 450 degrees. And that would destroy the tissues that our bodies are made out of, and life wouldn't exist. So having these chemical factories and organelles and so on to shepherd that in a fashion that we can extract energy without overheating is fundamentally necessary. And that happens because when you string proteins, so proteins are basically this sort of molecular form that has a tail that can have some other kind of molecule attached to it, and that molecule will have different properties which cause a long string of these things to twist around. And it's also possible for multiples to combine. So hemoglobin, I believe, is actually four copies of one thing that twists into a shape that then all cluster into the thing that we actually use to bring oxygen to our cells. So these things are incredibly complicated, but at the core, they work because dropping a protein into water or slightly salt, basically the environment of life, will inevitably cause it to twist up into one specific shape. And that one specific shape for the enzymes that we actually use to live has what's called an active region. Basically, there's this geometrical structure that's embedded in that shape that's capable of recognizing and connecting to specific atoms or molecules and putting those things next to one another, perhaps in ways that cause the shape itself to deform to then break or make specific kinds of chemical reactions happen at very low energies.
And for anybody maybe less familiar with organic chemistry, I remember when I took it in college, I took one organic chemistry class, and it was fascinating. I would have loved to take more, but I didn't have time with my major, and that was all that was required. So molecules, organic molecules, have specific 3D shapes.
Right.
And you can have two molecules that have the same chemical formula and at first glance the same structure, but it's like having a right hand and a left hand. The same pieces, the same components acts the same, except there's a right-handed and left-handed version. In fact, and they're different. One could be necessary for life, and one could be a deadly poison.
Can. That's the the thing that caused the deformities in the babies. Starts with a T. Name's not coming to me right now, but that was a chirality, a mirror version.
And there's actually, I'm going to spoil a book right now, so this is a spoiler alert, but it's an old book. Spock Must Die. Yep. It's an old Star Trek book, and so I'm going to spoil the whole thing right now. In Spock Must Die, there's this thing far away that they're trying to investigate. So they devise a modification to the transporter that enables beaming somebody with tachyons. So it's faster than light. Tachyons are a hypothetical particle, faster than light particle. But to beam somebody far, far away, and then so they're like, all right, Spock has the expertise. He can go. But the modification to the transporter required like sealing it off somehow so that nobody could see inside while the transportation was conducted. So they beam Spock out, and then they open the door, and there are two Spocks in there. And they're like, what is this? what is going on here? Well,
yeah, the transport beam bounces off.
Claimed to be the real one.
Exactly. It bounces off and creates a mirror and then Spock, now, which the real Spock realizes means that the mirror Spock is purely evil.
So Spock never arrived at the destination. Yes. He bounced off of a shield. There are two Spocks. One of them is evil. They both claim to be the real Spock. One closes himself off in medbay. And it turns out he did so that he could eat, because he was the left-handed Spock. He was the evil Spock, and he required left-handed proteins. So as it were, he required the mirror image because he was a mirror image. He couldn't eat the regular ship's fare.
So tryptophan, that's thalidomide. That's it. Thalidomide is the thing. So there was thalidomide was being used as a pain reliever and was being given to pregnant women. Thalidomide has a mirror image. One side of it actually works as a pain reliever. The other side of it, sadly, interferes with fetal development and causes babies to be born without their long bones developing. So sort of very short arms, very short legs, that kind of thing. And the problem wasn't that they were being given the wrong sidedness, handedness version. The problem is that in the body, the one-handedness version converts to the other-handedness version. And so they were being given the handedness that causes the beneficial health effects. And then their body was turning it into the handedness that causes fetal development problems. We found that out the hard way.
Isn't it often a challenge in manufacturing that oftentimes the manufacturing process produces both?
Well, so this is a major issue in general with chemically producing biological things. So people might be familiar with hydrogenated fats. In general, animals produce fully saturated fats and plants produce partially saturated fats. And that goes down to fat essentially has three hydrocarbon chains off of something called a fatty acid. And because biochemical systems build things effectively atom by atom, if you look at a biologically produced fat molecule under a microscope, the hydrocarbon tails will sort of all line up with each other because they were built right like that. The more saturated the fat is, the sort of the thicker it is. So butter is fully saturated. Margarine, if they didn't saturate it in some way, would just be liquid, and that's not as attractive. So what they do is they more or less shoot hydrogen atoms at it and force more hydrogen into those bonds. But because...
Don't they like run it over a catalyst?
Yes. Yeah.
In the presence of water?
Yeah. But water is, mostly hydrogen from a particle standpoint. So it isn't terribly practical to use actual particle accelerators, but that's basically they're just, piling hydrogen at the thing and making it react. So the problem is that those bonds, when they hydrolyze, can go in basically any one of 360 degrees of directions. And when you're not building it up atom by atom, when you look at saturated, hydrogenated, so-called things, those tails don't line up anymore. They start going off in all sorts of random directions. And some people, there's some science supporting the notion that these sort of furrier fats are harder for the body to cope with, and that's one of the problems that we have with our diets and so on, is that we're eating these things that our bodies can cope with but are working in different ways to do, because it's all down to these shapes, and the shapes aren't exactly the same when we do it in a vat versus we do it the other way.
So these shapes are terribly important, as we can see. So how does Google's DeepMind, like, how do they do this protein folding? How do they,
well, so there's,
how does this come into the real world?
So the first problem is we're very good at figuring out what protein sequences actually are. And we're very good at figuring out what genetic sequences actually are. There are machines that will do that science and pump out these long lists of, you know, character strings, basically. We weren't particularly good at taking that character string and figuring out what shape it was going to be. And a couple of years ago, this is sort of a big deal in biology, and people have been working on it for decades. A couple of years ago, Google, their team, won a folding competition, and then basically got a lot better at it from there. So they built a system which cracked some kind of code where you could hand it a sequence of characters. You could just say, what if this protein was, or this amino acid was followed by that amino acid was followed by that amino acid, like, what would the protein wind up looking like? And then there's much more expensive and non-automated chemistry we can do to crystallize these things and then do X-ray diffraction, so we can work out what the shapes are with enormous amounts of work. They found a what seems to be a highly efficient mechanism to figure out what those shapes are. Now, that's very cool, but it's not unbelievably valuable. What's unbelievably valuable is that we know what shapes are useful to various chemical reactions because we know what the geometry of chemistry is. That was sort of humankind's major project from like the 1700s through the 1900s, was figuring out what all of the elements were and how they could all fit together. So any chemical reaction that might be of commercial or biological interest, there's some shape of enzyme that could exist that would make that chemical reaction more efficient or more frequent or in other ways more useful. And there's a shape, an active shape on that enzyme that would cause it to have that property. And so if you can take a character string.
So where do the super soldiers come in?
Maybe soon. We don't know. If you can take a character string and figure out what the shape is, then step two is plugging a shape in and determining a character string. And relatively recently, they released another paper where they created an enzyme that can depolymerize plastics. So plastics work very similarly. They're basically long strings of similar or exactly the same, in most cases, molecules to create these very long molecules that, because they're very long, have these very nice properties for our general physical use. The problem, of course...
So there's a... Sorry, just a concept for a story. Maybe I'll write it. Maybe somebody else will write it. Maybe it's already written somewhere. But this enzyme that breaks down plastics, which is great news, you know, have it be propagated by bacteria, have those bacteria out in the world, and now all plastic deteriorates quickly. So basically we no longer make things out of plastic and it changes the world. What would that do to the world? Just because there's this enzyme that is produced by bacteria that float around in the world.
Yeah. And in fact, this is something that sort of has happened.
The Andromeda strain.
Well, that's an interesting tale too. The Carboniferous period, is so named because there's basically this black bar in strata. And what happened was that plants figured out how to make cellulose, and trees started to happen. And for millions, tens of millions of years, no enzyme evolved that could break down cellulose. So these days, a tree falls over in the forest, beetles and other things go to work and start breaking it down. After, you know, a couple of years, it's basically tissue paper, and then it's just soil. But that's not what was happening. Trees would fall over.
I see that in the northern Virginia.
And they'd just sit there because nothing could eat a tree. And so trees would fall over until there was so much fuel burden lying around that great fires would happen and carbonize things, and that those carbons turned into carbon layers, which created most of the coal seams and many of the oil and natural gas seams that we're exploiting today. That's the fossil and fossil fuels isn't so much dinosaurs, it's trees for the most part. So we could see that kind of a scenario, but the same thing that allows that breakdown, in theory, allows the build up as well. So we have certain kinds of plastics that have extraordinary characteristics. We could see hybridization. So bone has very good strength characteristics. But we have concretes with better strength characteristics. We could theoretically create the enzymes that would allow our bones to be replaced with better kinds of lithochemistries or other things like that. The potential with bacteria to allow us to start building materials at the atomic or molecular level efficiently changes the game across a wide variety of scenarios, including from the super soldier perspective. If anyone figures out how to, say, improve the efficiency of muscle fiber by altering the basic chemistry of how those muscle fibers are put together. And again, that's not necessarily something that requires people to come up with. One of the properties of like Olympic professional world-class athletes is that in most cases, they have fundamentally different kinds of biologies that work in different ways. So Michael Phelps, for example, there's a famous example. There's this measure that has to do with muscular soreness. And so for most people, if this measure gets up into the high teens or low 20s, they effectively have to be hospitalized. They'd have so much muscular soreness that they would be completely unwilling to move. There are certain professional athletes that have much higher tolerances, whether that's because they have much higher pain tolerances or they have something else biologically going on that means that it doesn't hurt them as much.
Like 15 bananas a day.
Or maybe it's a dietary thing. But there's other kinds of professional athletes where this number just never goes up very high. So there's people who can walk around and exercise with this number in the 30s. And then there's Michael Phelps, who, when he was cycling through winning multiple gold medals, the number never hit double digits. So something about the efficiency of his muscles might be fundamentally better than the efficiency of most of our muscles. And
genetics have a huge play, and people downplay genetics a lot for a good reason. But wait, really quick. I saw part of a documentary. I don't remember this guy's name, but they were talking about him, how he's quite remarkable because maybe it's the same thing that Michael Phelps has going on, but he could run and run and run, and he didn't overheat. His muscles didn't cramp. Like he some people can run through Death Valley in the middle of the summer, and they run on the, like, there's a race. There's a, is it called the Badwater 100? I don't remember, but there's a race through Death Valley in the middle of summer, and they run on the white stripe on the side of the road, so their shoes don't melt. But some people can do this. Anyway, so genetics are play a huge part in things. And yes, we should, or no, we shouldn't let genetics prevent us from doing what we aspire to do within reason. You know, we should take chances and make mistakes and learn and grow. But for anybody, so like coming from a musician background, I have learned something about myself, and that's that I am slow. My brain signals, maybe my nerve signals as well. I'm slow. I don't perceive things as rapidly as other people do. And that makes it difficult for me as a clarinetist. That makes it difficult for me to play things fast as precisely as some other people can. I got good enough. I played through college. I played for the Marine Corps for several years. So I got good enough to go and start a career at it. But it was always kind of a limiting factor. And some people say, like, you know, go practice. I'm like, well, yeah, I have been.
Right.
Go practice this specifically. Yeah, I have been. And so for anybody who wants to, like, downplay genetics, come, let's run a 3 mile.
Well, there's,
and I'll shut most of you up. I'm not an amazing fast 3 miler, but I'm good and solid. So most of you, sorry, it sounds like I'm trying to confront people, but I'm saying, like, running long distance is something that I'm moderately good at. Playing clarinet is something that I'm moderately good at, and there are few people who are at my level or higher in both. And so if you're thinking, like, oh yeah, if you put in the work, you can do it. Like, I don't know why you're not as good as me. You're obviously not putting in the work. Well, how about let's try this other activity that's not your bag and see if you can do as well as I can. Genetics play a different part. I would love for some enzyme to speed up my nerve signals. I would love for that to be a thing.
Maybe, yes. So there was when Britain hosted the Olympics, they punched well above their weight class in medals. And one of the reasons they were able to do this is that they embarked on a measurement campaign of the entire country to find people that would be biomechanically suited to various things. And so they had this woman, I believe it was in rowing. She got a gold, and a year before the Olympics, she was just a nurse somewhere, but she had some kind of, like, forearm to upper arm ratio thing that meant the leverage that she was able to potentially produce. And once they identified her and offered her training and she did the work, you know, it's not like she just left her nursing thing and went out and got a gold medal, but she had a biomechanical advantage because of the relative lengths of her arm bones that was effectively untouchable by a world of people who had spent considerably larger amounts of their lives dedicated to this sport. The NBA has a fairly recent thing. I can't remember this guy's name. It starts Wemby. That's it. That's his nickname. But it's this 19-year-old. He's 7'4", which is tall, but not except that there are people who have been that tall or taller in the NBA before. He has, like, an 8-foot wingspan, maybe more than 8 feet. If he holds his hands out fingertip to fingertip, it's more than 8 feet long. He got the first what's known as 5-5s in NBA history. So that's 5 points, 5 assists, 5 blocks, steals, and those are the crazy ones, and rebounds. And it's just the case that he can physically reach over about an extra foot or more than anybody else on the court can. And it might be the case that eventually people will be able to put together strategies and tactics that can cope with people who, him specifically, being able to reach sort of an extra half person around the court. But for his rookie season, playing relatively part-time because he's a 19-year-old, he's not even fully grown yet. When he was on the court, his team had the highest defense rating in the league. And when he's off the court, his team had the lowest defense rating in the league. So he's potentially a complete game changer if that sort of thing can be persistent. And obviously, simply being 8 feet wide isn't something that you can train for.
Yeah. It's something you can breed for, but then we get into ethics.
Certainly, so, yes.
Yeah, genetics and ethics, they go hand in hand. When you start playing with genetics, and yeah, genetics do a lot of things. And so like I mentioned, I'm a decent runner. I am not amazing, especially right now because I'm finally coming off of an injury. For the last year and a half, I've my knee's been bad, but I've done a 3 mile in 19 minutes, which is not super fast. It's not like competition level, but in the Marine Corps, everyone has to run 3 miles, and I do decent at that, like a little better than most. But you put a pack on my back and we go for a hike, I'm in the rear. I am not a good hiker. And it's not that I'm not trying. I have injured myself. Funny story, at Officer Candidate School, we had a 6 mile hike and I fell behind my platoon, and thus I failed. You know, everything is given a grade, and I was given a failing grade for that hike, but I finished it, so they didn't make me repeat it. And I got a negative counseling from my platoon commander, and because it's how they work. You know, they have to have some means of sifting through people.
Absolutely, yeah.
So this counseling is kind of like a letter to document it, like you did something we don't like. So that if you keep doing things that we don't like, then we can show a preponderance of evidence and get you kicked out of this officer candidate school and you don't get to be an officer. Anyway, so I got this negative counseling from my platoon commander, and you also have to provide a response to it. But this negative counseling accused me of mental weakness of lacking physical courage was what it was. And in my response, you know, I filled it with tact. I said it with utter tact and respect, but I'm like, hello, I literally pushed past my physical limit. I had a heat stroke right after it. I had a temperature of 104.5 degrees. Like I was all seizing up, and it was a good thing that there was medical care on hand, which they have on hand, because sometimes people have heat strokes, and like that could have killed me.
Yes. Yeah. I'm rather prone to heat stroke myself. I'm not very happy.
Oh,
about
yeah.
It.
And it was so scary because I was afraid of dying and leaving my family without a provider. Oh, that was the worst thing. The worst thing was being scared of not being able to take care of my family. Anyway, it turned out all right. But I'm a decent runner. I'm a weak hiker. And I guess I could have prepared better for OCS. I could have gone to the gym and done more squats to make my legs stronger. But that's, I could have increased my capability up towards a limit, and that limit is set by genetics and diet. Like, you can max things out as much as possible, but there is a limit. And mine for hiking happens to be a lower limit than some of my peers whose limit for running is lower than mine. So trade-offs.
Right.
Anyway, so we're like way off. So how can we play with these limits? How can we use genetic engineering or protein folding to play with and raise some of these limits, or just make them irrelevant altogether? How would we go about that?
In all likelihood, there will effectively always be trade-offs. If we figure out how to efficiently create arbitrary molecular engines, then our existing biological powers, like with bacteria, as you mentioned, have pretty extraordinary capacities that may be unlocked, and could even be unlocked within ourselves without the necessity of biological interference. Humans have an enormous number of bacterial fauna that we have resident in our bodies that allow us to digest what we actually eat, with E. coli, for example, and other things. And so we could smuggle in, if you will, some of these capabilities through genetic engineering of these other flora, potentially. And so you could start imagining various super soldier scenarios with these different kinds of capabilities, with conscious engineering of the chemical processes that are involved.
Or even mitochondrial implants, or what if somebody, there are diseases caused by defective mitochondria, and correct me if I say something incorrect or if I state it in a manner that is not fully accurate, but it'd be life altering for those people with those diseases. But on the other hand, we could like swap out that person's mitochondria with a healthy person's mitochondria, then maybe we could, like, these powerhouses like Michael Phelps, obviously his mitochondria are healthy. You know, what if we could take those and I'm looking for the right word, not clone, but culture them?
Well, here's a fun one. Telomerase. One of the theoretical causes for aging is that when the chromosomes duplicate, you lose a little bit at the edge, but there's a.
But it's about the shape of the chromosome, isn't it?
Well,
the information is still there.
No. So it loses some information off the edges, but there's a enzyme that many species with reduced senescence, including some whale species that lives around Greenland and several other things, have that basically goes around the end and gets the whole chromosome. So if indeed that is a serious component, or even the only cause, then figuring out how to engineer that into our cell division process would result in reduced human senescence, basically a step. And that could be done either...
You mean like extending life as a result?
Well, yeah. So... It would be, it, it's not strictly speaking extending life. It's illuminating the effects of aging.
Okay.
Which could result in extended life, obviously, but has a lot of other potentially weird impacts as well. And of course, we also have endocrinal attachments to the aging process that wouldn't be strictly controlled there. So it might be the case that, say, people would remain biologically sort of young, but then die of cancer at roughly the same time because some other process causes that.
Mm-hmm.
Or heart disease or some, you know, maybe heart disease isn't mostly caused by the declining viability of the cells in the heart and muscle walls, and rather some sort of progressive buildup of failure just from the, you know, coursing of that much blood through the system. So
I do have to say, like, shout out to humans throughout the 20th century. The fact that we look at heart disease and cancer as such huge killers speaks to the fact that we're living long enough for those to become
right.
The killers.
Right, exactly.
We've eliminated or greatly reduced many other killers.
Right. And of course, another possibility would be if sort of everybody is in their mid-20s for their entire lives, the aggressive responses that people tend to start losing in their 40s wouldn't go away. And with many more aggressive human beings in the gene pool, our murder rates could spike, and that could drop our life expectancies. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of different ways that things could happen from mm-hmm. these sorts of impacts. And again, fertile zone for thinking through these science fiction scenarios.
Yeah.
So the other thing is communication. We already have systems that for like amputees and so on that can communicate with neural peripheral neural communication. So people can have fake hands, for example, that they can control through the muscles of their still remaining arm. The muscle and nerve impulse of their still remaining arm can then affect actuators uh-huh. that control the hand. AI can greatly extend this capacity. And so we could see huge upticks in sort of human-machine interface where it could be possible for specific AI systems to co-learn a control language with a person. So you could essentially find the set of behaviors that idealized some other outcome. One, I've talked about this with buddies. I've never seen anybody actually do this, but from a video game standpoint, video games have typically some sort of controllers. If you're, you know, operating on the keyboard mouse, there's some specific control, and usually there's some degree of customization that people can undergo to get things to work the way they want them to work. But mm-hmm. one potential that's becoming more and more available is that the way that the player uses the control structure could actually be something that the game learns. And so you could have a player character interface level up where you would become better at playing your character when you were capable of, you yourself were capable of physically teaching the game the difference between two different kinds of activities. And so you could have a game where your character was capable of some menu of activities that you could unlock on a personal basis by being able to use the controls in ways that distinguished and combined those various activities.
I am not a neuroscientist, but I believe, so again, there's the caveat, I'm not a neuroscientist, I could be wrong, but this is, I guess, anecdotal. My observations have led me to believe that that's how we learn to use our own real physical bodies. That if you watch a baby, their movements are just kind of random for a newborn. And when they cry, it's kind of the same, but more so. You know, they do a lot of kicking and just punching their arms out. And I think that's because as our brain is active and it doesn't know how to interact with the world, we send all these signals. And as over time, over those weeks and months and those first few years, we observe that when I'm thinking, we don't really think it consciously nowadays. And if we could rewind down to 6 months, would we be thinking about it? Like, oh, look at that. Like I've watched my kids and my nieces and nephews, and my brother shared a video with me of when his son discovered his hands. You know, he's just kind of looking at it and he's saying like, oh, I am doing this motion. You know, I am doing this. And so the brain sends out all these random signals and we get this stuff. And it honestly reminds me of when I was on the stretcher having my heat stroke and my arms were here. They were tensed up and I couldn't let them go because, I don't know, something about electrolyte imbalance, right. But I was doing this and I couldn't not do it because that was the signal that was being sent and it was constant and it was strong. So as we are babies and we do these random signals, we send these random signals to our limbs. We notice what we are doing. Like, oh, when I think this, or when I feel this way, my hand does this. And
well, so that's,
so what you're saying.
Yeah. Not only is that a pretty good model of how we do things, we actually have experience with what it would be like as a near adult to do this because we teach people how to drive cars in their teens. And when you first get behind a wheel, it's quite jerky, usually. Your use of the control surfaces, you stop shorter than you think that you should be stopping. You start up more, you know, unevenly. It's very similar, and you undergo a very similar process of, whoops, I don't like that happening. How do I change the way I behave to make things be more controlled, be more under our actuation? So, as our ability to improve sensory devices improves, and they're already at an extremely high degree, it becomes possible for us to use more of the body's information to control machinery that's around us. We could have systems that adjusted our air conditioning based on our body temperature or, our hand position and so on. And so there's a real possibility that we could develop new control technologies that would operate off of adaptive instructions that could be connected to significantly larger scale machinery outcomes. So we have self-driving
exoskeleton.
Yeah. Well, forget that. Imagine entire machine yards under the control of a puppeteer. We have self-driving tractors. What if you had a feedback mechanism that would allow you to operate like a factory floor with the necessary feedback sensory, like, you know, you had an audio visual input that let you know how a car assembly line was working in ways that you could actuate, in ways that you had adapted to learn how to actuate, and so you could use this entire system in that fashion. So yeah, we could go way past sort of what we're personally doing to being able to control broader environments in much deeper fashions as one potential in our sort of sensory and neural space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we're running a little long now, so I think I'll call it a pod. And why don't you remind our listeners where they can find you with your podcast?
So you can find me on The Fourth Age, The AI Revolution. It's on Spotify, Apple. We're up on YouTube. I also have a petition. If any of you would like to support my efforts to upgrade economics on change.org under CDM patent. And you can learn more about the system itself there or on my website, corddisc.com.
Thank you. And thanks for coming on the podcast today.
Thanks for having me.